It's the Burt Cohen Show. I'm waiting to talk to our guest. He's out in California. Seem to be some crossed wires, as they say in the business, something like that. And we hope to talk to Bill Shireman, who is president and CEO of something called Future 500, a nonprofit that builds alliances between business, labor, environmental, and political interests on the left and right. Be interesting to find out what that organization is exactly. And during the election, Bill Shireman notes that both Obama and Romney talked as little as possible about specifics that might actually work to rebuild the economy. We're hoping to talk to Bill Shireman about his recent piece in Collier's magazine, where Shireman offered a six-pronged proposal to actually build a more prosperous and sustainable community. I'm hoping he might call in real soon, because we don't have him quite yet. But meantime, well, actually, do you want to talk about what happened on Friday? Give us a call at 603-430-9722. What do you think? Is it time for realistic gun laws? How different might this be? There's been talk a lot in the past after every gun disaster. Oh, we got to do something. And guess what, folks? Nothing seems to ever happen. I certainly remember when after Martin Luther King was killed in April, and then in June, it was Bobby Kennedy's turn. And right after that, we thought, oh, man, there's going to be gun control now. We have to do something. We can't continue to have guns this out of control. And guess what? We saw what happened. Basically nothing. We'd love to hear from you at 603-430-9722. This is not what I was planning on discussing today, but the gray weather, it's kind of on everybody's mind here in the Seacoast and across America. What do we do about guns? What about the power of the gun lobby, the NRA? The National Rifle Association, of course. Do they have blood on their hands? Or should we do what people in the NRA suggest? Well, just arm the teachers. What do you think about that idea? Should the teachers be armed? Or perhaps might a crossfire in the classroom be a little bit more dangerous for the kids? What do you think? Have you seen the pictures of the kids? How do you think the media has been handling it? I am certainly not going to mention the name of the killer. I don't even want to know the name of the killer. You know, those are the people that get all the attention, but they're the names of the kids. There's 20 of them, so it's a little bit hard. But if you've looked at the pictures of it, what can we do about it? Is it realistic? Are we going to forget? What can be done about it? Do you have experience with any guns or massacres? Are you a gun owner yourself? Do you think there should be controls on large capacity magazines? You don't need those to hunt ducks. You don't need those to hunt deer. And some people have said, I've seen stuff where they live on a farm, they have sheep, they have dogs, and sometimes coyotes come in and attack their domestic animals, and they feel like they can't keep their gun locked away. They need it right away, instantly, to get to it, to be able to defend their livestock and their pets. And I will confess that when my cat was destroyed by a coyote, obviously we understand that the coyote was pushed out of its territory, and you know we're in the coyote territory. However, we have a house there. It's been, you know, the house, the neighborhood has been there for 100 years anyway. Would I have shot that coyote? Frankly, yes, I would have. Absolutely. He stole my cat and killed him. Would I have done that? Yes, I would have, to help save other people. Would I need anything bigger than a 22 single shot rifle? I don't think so. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. I know this is last minute. This is not what we were planning. I had a sense that this guy wasn't going to be there today. He's out in California. Bill Shireman, if you hear me, your secretary wanted to know how she could listen to it, and I gave her the information. If you're listening, please have him call me. Our number here is 603-430-9722. 603-430-9722. Will the president have enough backbone now? He's free enough. He doesn't need to worry about pleasing the South, the old Confederacy, which has this gun value uber alles. They want guns to reign supreme. He doesn't need them anymore for the election. Even the senators who were bought and paid for by the NRA are starting to have some questioning now. Could it do anything? Is the threat of confiscation of all guns too much of a threat? I don't think anybody is intending that, but would it do anything? You know, will new laws be able to do anything about the gun violence, or is it too late? Are there already too many guns out there? I note that gun sales here in New Hampshire have gone up quite a bit since the massacre. Yes, there was that Riley's gun shop that reported record sales over this particular weekend, the last weekend. People are buying guns. I'm sure it's not to further protect themselves, but they're concerned about new gun laws coming down. They want to get them while they can. There have been countries where they made changes. I believe Scotland was one. They made some changes in the assault weapons laws and, frankly, confiscated them, did take them away from people. That doesn't affect their Second Amendment rights. And guess what? It saved a lot of lives. There have not been any massacres since they passed that law. And let's look at the Second Amendment, if you will. The Second Amendment, maybe I can put it up on the internet here, doesn't say anything about assault weapons. What it says is, let me take a look here. Let me see if I can get to it now. I know pretty well what it is, that they're a well-regulated militia. Let me just type in Second Amendment. The typing going on here, let's see what it says, if it comes up, if this funky old computer. Yes, here it is. Let's see what the Second Amendment says. Come on. Gives me some other junk. Of course. Let's see what we get here. If you just tuned in, this is not what I was expecting. I was hoping for a guest. I had a feeling there might be some difficulty. Here is what it said. And again, Mr. Shireman, if you are listening, give us a call, 603-430-9722. He is scheduled to be on here, but hasn't called in. I haven't been able to reach him. All right, let's take a look. This is the Second Amendment. Think about this. A well-regulated militia. Do we have a well-regulated militia right now, or is it out of control? These people that have all these assault weapons, the large-capacity magazines that have 30 clips in them, can tape them together and make them even more than that, is that well-regulated? The Constitution, which the right wing likes to go back to all the time, they refer to the Second Amendment, and they worship the Second Amendment. And let's think about that. It starts out, I mean, the Constitution doesn't mince words. It's exactly what it means. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Of course, at the time they meant the states being the sovereign, the place of sovereignty, the locus of government, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Okay, the right of the people to keep and bear arms follows the phrase a well-regulated militia. So what this is specifically referring to, this right of the people to keep and bear arms, is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state shall not be infringed. Does that mean anybody and everybody can have all the guns they want, machine guns? Why limit machine guns? Because they're a threat to society. Why limit assault guns? Because they're a threat to society. Are assault weapons necessary? Are they part of a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state? They are not. We need to look at what the Second Amendment is. If these right-wing, dangerous people who love their guns would read it and understand it, the phrase, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, is not there in the Constitution by itself. It follows the most important part of the Second Amendment, which is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms is a subset of that. That shall not be infringed. That is not what we have now. And it's also pointed out that in the time of the writing of the Constitution and the Second Amendment, it took a long time to load a gun. It was not easy. They were muzzle loaders. You had to put each, not even a bullet, a ball in there. And it took a fair amount of time to do that. Guns oftentimes hurt the gun wielder more than the target of his or her anger or what they're trying to shoot for food. It's very, very different. Did they foresee 21st century ammunition that has been developed for the military through all these years? Of course not. Of course not. Do we threaten the Second Amendment by controlling guns? I would argue not at all. What's your opinion? 603-430-9722. 603-430-9722. I'm going to try this guy one more time. I don't think he's going to be here, but hang on with us, and let's see if our intended guest is there or not. So far, he has not been there. You are listening to a bit of a surprise Burt Cohen show. We go from noon to 1, and welcome your input, 603-430-9722. Apparently, he's not there. Well, that's most unfortunate. But we'd love to hear from you. You were not expecting to have this capability to call in, so you may not be handy to a phone. But we'd love to hear from you. What can be done about these murders, these killings, these massacres? And what about mental health? Interesting how funding for mental health, public health, really, it is public health. Funding has been cut all over the country. This guy was clearly a danger to society. Why is it that all those guns were there legally? Everyone he had was his mother's guns. How could she possess these semi-automatic assault weapons? And it's easy to define assault weapons. How is it that she had those? Was it necessary for target shooting? Was it necessary for protection? No. Do we infringe on the rights of Americans when we control guns? I'd like to hear from you. 603-430-9722. The NRA, the gun worshippers, are afraid that, well, if we start down this slippery slope, the government will become a tyranny and will take all our guns away and we will turn into a police state. That is the concern. believe me, I am just as much afraid of a police state as anybody. Coming from a Jewish background and knowing what a police state is like, reading about it in Nazi Germany, now that's beyond a police state. But when you give police tremendous powers and they're the only ones with guns, that is a dangerous situation. I may differ from some people on the left, which is one reason I don't call the show Portside anymore, because I'm not entirely left, but I do not favor the police having all the guns. The people need to have access to self-protection. It's true. I don't want to see a police state where the government has all the power and the people have none. We've seen that in places like China, places like the old Soviet Union. We don't want anything like that. That is what the NRA is afraid of. That's why they resist, or at least what they say, that is why they resist any and all sensible regulations on guns. Give us a call, 603-430-9722. We'd love to put you on the line here, get your opinions. I understand nobody was expecting this. I wasn't expecting it either. We should talk about this issue. It's a big, big issue. And I will tell you, talk about slippery slope. Being in the state Senate for 14 years, we'd hear that argument, slippery slope, over this or that issue again and again and again. Frankly, folks, I never buy the slippery slope argument, meaning that, well, once you do this, then it's just an easy slippery slope to this step, a bigger step. Doesn't happen. The legislature may have its difficulties and different interesting personalities, shall we say, but there is not a slippery slope. Each bill gets its own hearing. Each bill is heard and voted up or down based on its own merit. That is what happens. There's no slippery slope. So I can't think of specific incidents right now, but you know, about taking away people's rights, slippery slope. People were concerned that, well, if we control, for example, a bill I put in my early days was to ban the use, exploitation of exotic animals in circuses. You know, bears get abused. Elephants obviously get abused. A lot of animals get abused. Should we ban that? Well, people on the other side came out and said, well, this is a slippery slope. If we do this, we're going to ban all circuses. Well, no, there's lots of circuses that don't abuse animals, that don't exploit animals, or that, you know, will not let people have attack dogs if they want to train their dogs to protect their property. On and on and on. People felt like, well, if we have equal marriage rights, then we'll be forcing some alleged homosexual agenda on children, you know, turning kids into homosexuals. I couldn't make this stuff up. This is what people believe, that slippery slope is there. So when it comes to assault weapons, semi-automatic weapons, is it necessarily a slippery slope? I have yet to see the evidence. Where has it been the case where in these Western European countries, then, oh no, of course we don't want to be like Europe, right? But where they have controlled the possession and use of assault weapons, and guess what? People still have the rights. I understand they don't have the same Second Amendment, which we do here. We do have the Second Amendment. It can't be ignored. But people still have rights to own sensible guns. I put in legislation. One of the things I'm most proud of in my history in the state Senate was controlling the storage of guns, safe storage. Safe storage of guns is what we wanted to do, so that if you knew that a child was likely to be present, that you, under this legislation, you would be required to store the gun safely, either keep it locked up or store it safely, however you see fit. Of course, the other side said, oh, you're going to take away all our guns if you do this. This is the first step of a slippery slope to take away all our guns if you require safe storage of loaded weapons. Now, most gun owners are parents, and they, of course, do that. Most gun owners are sensible. Most gun owners, the vast majority, don't own assault weapons. They don't own multi-clip guns. They know they don't need that for hunting. But this was the argument that came forth, that if you do this, you take away all our guns. This is the first step. Well, guess what? We did pass. It didn't require safe storage, but we worked on it. I worked on it with a great guy who's a gun owner, who's an avid hunter, David Welch, who was unfortunately targeted by the ultra-right and did not get reelected. He was a legitimate conservative, but he didn't. Anyway, we worked something out so that it would recommend safe storage. It would list the ways where safe storage of loaded weapons is safe, and have on the counters of all gun shops the notice that you are advised to store guns safely. Now, they have this in Maine, and the counters there, you have to store guns safely. Does that infringe on your Second Amendment rights? Give us a call if you think it does. 603-430-9722. This is the Burt Cohen Show. I did not intend to be doing a monologue today, but this is every now and then a guest kind of falls through. I just had a feeling he was going to fall through on this one. And again, Bill Shireman, your secretary, emailed me today to ask how one could listen to the show. 603-430-9722. We can switch subjects and go to yours if you call in, although time is moving ahead. 603-430-9722. What do you think about the gun debate? Are people going to forget about it now? Is this going to be something where in a couple of weeks it'll be old news? People have such short memories in the United States, and that's one thing that has become clear in history, that people forget. They don't last very long, the issue of the day. I mean, for example, in the so-called Civil War, people still believe, there's the myth out there that war was fought to end slavery. It was not. And it's curious, interesting fact that the abolitionists of the North, the people who were considered the radicals at the time, who wanted to end slavery, force confiscation of what was then property, believe it or not, after slavery was ended through the war, and by the way, no other country used a war to end slavery, although slavery was ended everywhere in the world officially, they lost interest. The abolitionists, excuse me, lost interest in the issue of slavery and the rights of freed black people in the South, who after Reconstruction, where it started to be terribly abused, tremendous racial violence, they walked away from it. It wasn't their issue anymore. They had done their job. They were focusing on blacks in the West and keeping slavery out of the Western areas. They just walked away from it. There's a long history. The reason I mention that is a long history of Americans forgetting, just forgetting about an issue. It gets tired. It gets old. We want to move on. Do you think we'll move on from this one, or will there be actual gun legislation? Will President Obama show some backbone and take action on this now that he doesn't have to worry about getting reelected? Can it happen? Will it happen? Are you willing to do anything? We have a legislative delegation now made up of four women, three Democrats, and one Republican. I can tell you, the Democrats, they have certainly felt the influence of the NRA. However, Senator Jean Shaheen has already come out and saying she supports reasonable legislation as she has on the past. There was a law put in by Bill Clinton limiting assault weapons, the assault weapons ban. It was put in 2004. It expired in 2004 under the Bush administration, the frankly illegitimate Bush administration, given that they were not elected, although in the second term they were, but this was still 2004, they ended the assault weapons ban. The NRA threw their weight around. They have tremendous weight. They threw it around, and they ended the assault weapons ban. And if you want to do something about this, yes, it's great. I participated myself in a candlelight vigil. But we have to follow up on this. Some people actually say, now is not the right time, now is not the right place. What could possibly be a better time than to do it now when people are paying attention to this? But our Democrats, Annie Custer in the 2nd District, Carol Shea Porter in the 1st District, they're going to be good. We need to remind them. It doesn't hurt for you to call them and say we need sensible gun legislation that protects the Second Amendment rights and controls massacres. We are less, the phraseology now, instead of gun control, should be anti-massacre. We are anti-massacre activists now. We are parents of children. We are anti-massacre activists. The person you need to contact is Kelly Ayotte, our Republican senator who was elected in the right-wing sweep of 2010. She still, so far, is in the pocket of the NRA. She has got along with that idiot Boehner in this in so many things, with John McCain in their frenzy over Benghazi, which is just, I mean, they somehow imagine that Obama planned it and was somehow part of some Muslim terrorist. It's absolute nonsense. This is Kelly Ayotte for you. She's in the pocket of the NRA. She needs the pressure from the people. She needs the pressure from the people. That's where to focus this energy right now. We're all upset. We all have concerns about this shooting that happened, this terrible massacre of six-year-olds. Six-year-olds. Direct your attention. Write letters to Kelly Ayotte. And I've often mentioned on the show one of the greatest presidents, Franklin Roosevelt, who met with A. Philip Randolph, who was then head of the Pullman Porters Union. They were largely all black. and they wanted equal rights. Somebody just came in and showed me a bouquet of flowers, which was gorgeous. Very, very pretty. That Roosevelt met with A. Philip Randolph, one of the great civil rights leaders of all times. And he said, oh, I agree with you, Mr. Randolph. I agree with you. I want equal rights. I want this to happen. Now get out there and make me do it. Make me do it. The point is, believe it or not, it's eroded for sure, but we're still a republic. We still have somewhat of a democracy. In fact, we turned against the power of the plutocrats this time. We turned them back, and the people elected the person that the plutocrats didn't want. So we still have a republic. We still have a democracy. People power matters. Making noise out in the streets matters. If you don't make noise, it's complacency. Are you complacent in this massacre that just happened? Are you complacent? Do you want nothing to happen? Is it okay that this goes on? Of course you're not. But if you don't make noise, they're going to think there's complacency here. That's what politics is. You have to make some noise. This is beyond outrageous. This is just so shocking. What could possibly be worse than 26 six-year-olds being massacred? Have you seen the faces of these kids? We have to get out there on the streets now and make some noise. Write letters to the editor of all newspapers. Write to your member of Congress. Maybe you haven't done it before. Maybe you haven't been motivated to do it before. But now is the time to do it. If you have kids, you have grandkids, think about it. It could be them. Newtown, Connecticut could be anywhere in these United States. Our peaceful little areas here in the seacoast of New Hampshire, throughout New Hampshire, this plays in Concord, New Hampshire as well. We have to do something about this. We have to speak up. We have a newly elected governor from the state of New Hampshire, and she has said that she wants sensible gun control. We can do a lot in this state. It's not just the federal government. It's the state government can take action as well. They need to hear from you. I'd like to hear from you. 603-430-9722 is our number. Our intended guest didn't happen today, but boy, this is one heck of a topic here, and we'd love to hear from you. 603-430-9722. Can there be sensible anti-massacre legislation. That's really what it is. It's not so much gun control, which of course it is, but it's anti-massacre. Framing is extremely important, as we know. How you frame an issue is extremely important. Who could be for massacres? Obviously, nobody except very bizarre people like this particular shooter. And there have been so many. President Obama mentioned it in his talk to the group on Tuesday. And rather, that today's Tuesday, or at least it's being recorded on Tuesday. And Sunday night, President Obama talked about it. We have to push him into action. He hasn't done it before. He's been, frankly, afraid of the NRA. My gun legislation, I got to tell you what happened, why parts of it got defeated. We banned, we tried to ban multi-magazine clips. And let me see what we have here. Oh my goodness, I actually have our guest on the line. Let me see here. Let me see if I can get this. This has been a good discussion, I believe, but we're going to try to get to our guest. He's probably on line one. No, that's not the one. Maybe he's on line two. No, let me put on, maybe I can call him back. I'm going to try to get him. So if you can hold on for just a minute while I play a little bit of Gary Moore doing a dedication to Jimi Hendrix. Hold on, please. We'll be right with you.
Ladies and gentlemen, as I think has already been said, really the only thing you can follow Jimi Hendrix with is the national anthem. But here is somebody who he surely would have approved of, an inspirational guitarist in his own right, and his band, Mr. Gary Moore, together with Darren Mooney on drums, ex-Primal Scream, and Dave Bronz on bass, sideband with Eric Clapton, and many others. Mr. Gary Moore.
I'm thinking I have him. Bill, are you there?
I am here. Good morning.
All right. Good morning. I hate to break off from some Gary Moore imitation Jimi Hendrix, but we'll do it. He's very...
It's that extra boost on top of the caffeine.
Oh, my goodness. I've had lots of caffeine today, so we're in fine shape. Well, there's a we're going to switch subjects entirely here. There's been a paucity of realistic ideas to try new things that might actually improve our long-term economy. There's been a lot of stagnation on new ideas. Our guest today, better late than never, is Bill Shireman, president and CEO of something called Future 500. Well, Bill, thanks for being with us. What is Future 500 and how is it different? How is it unique? How do you, you know, hope to break through the stagnation that there's been in terms of really implementing some new ideas?
Well, you know, Frank, Future 500 is a nonprofit that tries to bring together the right and the left, tries to bring together corporations and activists on behalf of systemic solutions to issues. We see that the political process, of course, is gridlocked between a right and a left wing and between various interest groups that prevent us from moving forward. And we have the unusual proposition that if you can separate out the missions of both the right and the left from the special interests that tend to dominate them, that there is value on both sides, and that the real key to overcoming our current economic and ecological and social challenges is to bring together some of the core principles of the left and the right in smart policies to move us forward.
So do you work with, I mean, it sounds like a business venture, Future 500, like the Fortune 500, but it's Future 500. You're president and CEO. And I note that, you know, throughout at least 20th century American history, things oftentimes don't really happen until you get allegedly important business people to take a side one or the other. Ending the war in Vietnam, there was business executives against the war. Nixon finally got out when some business executives said, you know what, Dick, hey, it's time to go. So do you guys work with business people in particular or trying to build alliances?
We work with business people. We work with labor folks. We work with environmental activists. We work with a whole array. But the point for us is to try to build coalitions to enact systemic changes that can create the right kind of signals in the economy. For example, yes, we would like to see taxes reduced on income, on payroll, on profits, on savings, on areas of prosperity, and taxes increased on things like pollution and waste and carbon. And this is an area where there can be agreement on the right and the left. Now, unfortunately, the right has demonized, for example, the whole issue of climate change.
Yeah.
And the right, as it often is easily lured to support special interest perspectives when they're couched in ways that appeal to the premises of the right. So on the right, there's this prejudice against taxing carbon. But it really is smarter, and economists on the right agree that it makes sense to tax carbon. Now, coal companies aren't going to like the idea of taxing carbon.
Indeed.
But and so certainly we will have opposition from that, but the technology sector will benefit. Even the domestic oil industry will benefit, and the domestic natural gas industry will benefit. And, of course, renewables and efficiency will benefit from that. So it's important that we break the rights alignment with interest groups that take advantage of their rhetoric. And the same is true on the left.
Well, now, you raise some interesting points there. People have been concerned, or at least spoken about concerns with regard to our carbon tax, that people who drive cars, for example, that are kind of funky, that aren't as clean as the new cars, may have to pay a disproportionate share of the burden. And don't we, I mean, people like prosperity. Prosperity, of course, is a good thing. I think that's widely recognized. But we also have right now tremendous, I mean, just historically huge inequality between lower wage people and the top 1%, the top 2%. And, you know, the idea of cutting income tax seems sort of counterintuitive right now, cutting corporate taxes. But yet the idea of taxing what you don't want as opposed to taxing what you do want certainly has some merit. Where are we in discussion on what you just talked about with regard to carbon tax and cutting?
Well, the most regressive tax out there is the payroll tax.
Yes.
And so if you're dealing with people who have limited means, you're going to do much, much better by cutting payroll taxes and increasing carbon taxes to compensate. That gives people the money in their back pockets to buy a more fuel-efficient car, to make those upgrades in their homes and so on. So it gives them more choice at that level. As for corporate taxes, you know, as we know, the corporate tax is something of a fiction,
yes,
you know, as it stands. Large global companies can easily limit their corporate taxes through reporting of their earnings in foreign markets where, you know, where tax rates are lower. So
sure,
to some degree, it satisfies the Democrats rhetorically to say we have high corporate income taxes, and it satisfies the Republicans rhetorically to try to drive them down. But if we're going to tax corporate profits, let's actually tax corporate profits, but let's do it at a level that advantages American workers and advantages American economy in a fair way. And certainly today's corporate tax doesn't do that.
True. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. We're talking with our guest, Bill Shireman, president and CEO of Future 500. He wrote an article in Collier's magazine titled The Next Economy, and he offers a six-pronged solution that would hopefully forge a new and prosperous economy and allow all people a fair standard of living through a greener future. We've gone through the first two of the six, the carbon tax, reduced carbon by 5% every year for 50 years, not a bad idea, and cut personal income taxes, but thus make it easier to create new value and new wealth, which is also a good thing. The third in the sixth is to wind down resource subsidies. Now, the right wing is saying, well, if you do that, you know, if the government gets involved in the technology sector and subsidizes wind and solar and things like that, they're picking winners. What's your response to that?
Well, you know, you're, of course, as we know, and the right knows this as well as the left does, that we have subsidies across the board to energy sectors. And the problem we get into is that the right goes out and champions subsidies that tend to benefit coal and natural gas and oil and nuclear, and the left tends to go out and champion subsidies for all of those as well, and then they add solar and wind on top of that. The race to subsidize your favorite form of energy is not productive for the nation as a whole. It certainly makes sense for us to do intensive research and development into solar and wind and renewables. Research and development is a separate topic, but often politicians don't differentiate between legitimate research and development and simply guaranteeing a profit margin to investors in a set of technologies. So we think the left and the right need to get off the subsidy wagon and say, we have to internalize these costs. You know, we can't simply drop subsidies on wind and solar. We need to drop subsidies on wind, solar, coal, natural gas, nuclear, across the board. That means internalizing those externalities, not so that we can be mean and cruel to these industries and the people who work for them, but simply so that we make smart choices about our energy future.
One would hope we could do that, and it's interesting. I was pleased you mentioned nuclear. I didn't see the word in the article there, but nuclear is tremendously subsidized, largely through being shielded from any liability if there's an accident. If they had to go out on the free market and insure the nuclear plants, there would be no nuclear power plants. The taxpayers are subsidizing that. So it's a place where I would think the right and left could agree that the free market and not subsidizing might be a good thing. And again, we do need research and development. That's one of the great things that I think, again, the left and right could agree on, that we have in these currently United States been innovators through the years. And that's one reason we've done so well throughout our not all that long history. you know, that the free market can work there. And another point of the so that's three. Another point of the six-pronged solution that you offer in the article is what you call our most abundant source, the digital efficiencies generated through information and communications technology. What do you mean by that? How can we benefit through that?
Yeah, the form of energy that the left in particular really misses is the extraordinary gains in resource efficiency, in energy efficiency and materials efficiency that are brought about through technology, particularly digital technology. If you look at the gains in productivity that the United States and the developing world has achieved, and now the bottom billion and the bottom 2 billion across the world are achieving real gains because people are gaining access to information and to communications through the internet, through digital technology. Those technologies bring about efficiencies that spread through the whole economy. Individually in these technologies, sometimes efficiencies of fivefold, tenfold, even more.
Wow.
And across the economy, they help us to grow economically without consuming more resources. And this is really key. As the global economy reaches physical resource limits, we need to grow the way nature grows. Nature grows by becoming more complex, more internally smart. Nature doesn't continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Nature gets better and better and better. And that's the way we have to grow our economy. The biggest source of energy is this energy that comes from efficiency, that comes from smarter materials, smarter systems, smarter people that produce more value using less stuff. So that's where we advise, if you will, the left to look for more opportunity. The fixation on renewables. And we certainly support renewables.
Oh, yeah.
We think there's tremendous potential in renewables. But it's kind of the easy out for the left when you want to oppose coal, natural gas, oil, and people ask you, well, so what are we going to run the economy on? Well, it's going to be solar and wind. Well, that's too easy an out.
That's also not enough.
The key opportunity, and that is energy efficiency.
And that's one thing that some people in, for example, the anti-nuclear movement for decades now have been saying, you know, here's this highly centralized, tremendously capital-intensive, frankly dangerous industry where we're wasting huge percentages of energy, something like 30% of energy. If you could retrofit buildings, make things more efficient, you can save much more energy than you can create through all these other sources. And solar and wind are very nice, but let's face it, you know, we can't just, the turnaround time is not real quick, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How can we find the reality to retrofit buildings, to stop, you know, heating the outside through inefficient windows
right.
and things like that?
Right. I think, you know, again, and we're focusing much on the fallacies of the left, and the fallacies of the right are equally compelling. But what the left tends to err toward is, well, we'll have the government do a big program to install energy efficiency improvements, you know, in every building across the country. At the beginning of the Obama administration, this was what was going to be employing, you know, millions of people. But we find that the right is correct when it comes to the capacity of government to carry out these gigantic programs in a very rapid way. Government is not very capable of doing that. But you know what? The private sector is. And so if we move to things like carbon taxation, where it suddenly becomes economically viable and even compelling for people across the economy, from the individual consumer to the biggest company, to institute these changes, they will do so. And that's what drives jobs and growth in conservation. It's steps like that. So the right tends to understand how these economic incentives work. And that's why, oddly, you have so many right-wing economists who like the idea of carbon taxes and taxes on pollution, and folks on the left who say, well, that's a good idea, but we want mandates. We want the government to go out and do this. I'd say that the right has something to learn from the left in that pollution has to be priced. The left has something to learn from the right in that pricing pollution can outperform these big government adventures.
It seems to work that way. Like supply and demand is kind of a law of nature, and at the same time, you know, we're not either or. We're certainly not Marxists or socialists, despite what some, you know, wacky people on the right might say. Nor are we entirely radically free market, uncontrolled, anarchistic market. We have something in between. And incentives, perhaps, Bill Sharman, might be part of that. That it's not, you know, if you have an incentive, that's not socialism on a slippery slope, is it?
No, I think that the point is, you know, incentives and subsidies are not what we want to look for. Incentives, if they are the right kinds of incentives, if you're ensuring that people are paying more when they're hurting society, people are paying less when they're helping society. That's the key here.
Yeah, good point.
It's internalizing these externalities, and that's what we want to aim toward.
If you just tuned in, we're talking to Bill Sharman, president and CEO of Future 500, about an article, a six-pronged solution that might really realistically help the economy. The sixth here, we've gone over five of them, is interesting, I think, now that we've been outsourcing so many jobs because it's cheaper to do so. You know, you pay less, there's no environmental standards. You suggest, Bill Sharman, apply the same price on pollution to imported goods. Now, that's interesting. Talk about that.
Well, the idea is that if we're taxing carbon here in the United States, then we have the right to impose equivalent taxes on goods and services that come into the United States. If you have a country like China, which is growing its coal energy base at an extremely rapid rate, I think something like 300 times faster than it's growing its renewables, you have a net gain in carbon pollution every time you export jobs to China. Now, it makes sense for us to apply that carbon intensity to their imports. The effect of that will be when China shifts away from coal and reduces its carbon intensity, its goods become more competitive. To the extent that they are more dependent on coal and on high carbon intensity, their goods and services become less competitive here. That makes it better for the U.S. economy, which is more energy efficient, has a lower carbon intensity than China does. And it gives us a chance at the jobs. It tends to correct for the phenomenon where countries with low pollution standards, low environmental standards, gain an unfair advantage.
Boy, a level playing field. What a concept.
Well, the right has been talking, and I think quite legitimately, they've said, why is the United States supposed to pay all this money to protect climate when the big emitters of the future, China and India, don't?
Right.
This is an elegant way to accomplish that objective. So the right is satisfied, the left is satisfied, and guess what? We actually do something for the environment instead of just looking like we're doing something for the
Oh, it's so much fun to look like we're doing something.
Well, that seems to be the preferred course for politicians. Just look like you're doing something.
Oh my goodness!
So that you'll be reelected, so that you can continue to look like you're doing something.
And of course, that may come up in the recently raised issue of gun control, anti-massacre legislation. But we won't get on there now.
Sure.
What's going to make these ideas happen? I mean, we have lobbies that seem to have tremendous power over what happens, over the direction that Congress goes. We have agribusiness. We have fossil fuels. How can we, the people, I mean, gain this actual political muscle? We don't have the kind of zillions of dollars that the lobbyists have. How can we be empowered to force real change? What's your sense of Congress?
The people that are listening to you right now, every one of them has the capacity to be a leader. I think a lot of it is ideological impulse control. It is so easy for vested interests, and I don't mean to even talk down vested interests, because we are all vested interests.
Right.
But I'll tell you, 10,000 times a day in Washington, D.C., people are sitting around a room figuring out how they can trigger the impulses of the right or the left to support their interests on the margin on these little issues. So you have the right that falls into these traps. They are easily convinced by the gun lobby that free access at gun shows to assault rifles are protected by the Second Amendment. You know, it's an argument that serves the interest of a very narrow special interest, a set of companies that make a particular weapon, and they're able to trigger the impulsive reaction of folks on the right to support their interests. You know, the left falls into these same traps where, you know, they can be triggered to support handouts of free medical care from doctors and nurses without ever changing the power structure in healthcare to drive down real costs. So they can be easily convinced that in order to give people free healthcare, we have to further empower institutions that are already in power in the healthcare sector. Progressives and conservatives need impulse control. They need to steel themselves against being easily swayed by these interests that seem to be based in their mission, but actually corrupt their mission. And that means, I think, an alliance between folks on the right and the left to say, look, let's have some reasonable policies that advance both our missions at one time.
And do you see that happening? Are there organizations, I know that there have been tries in the past to bring people together. And I have to say, I'm reminded of one of my many favorite quotes. H.L. Mencken said, to every complex problem, there's a simple solution, and it's wrong.
Yeah.
We're talking about complex.
I think there's an underlying movement for this, but it has not solidified into a cohesive political movement, not by any means. Our group, you know, certainly I encourage people to join with Future 500, write us at info@future500.org, visit our website. We will be talking about this and helping groups forge these kinds of alliances. But it hasn't really been done, and clearly it needs to be done. And I think any one of your listeners now that wants to find a passion for their life and their political potential, here's a way. Here's a path. We need leaders. Leaders are self-defined. Let's get out there and lead.
Of course, I had a lot more questions. One more I got to ask. The military right now, the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower so famously warned us against, they're a huge part of our budget, a huge part of our values right now. Doesn't that have to be addressed as well?
Oh, sure. You know, it's not just the military-industrial complex. And again, I don't mean to demonize any sector. I see problems, you know, in the labor movement, in the corporations, in government, and so on, primarily around power that gains control and doesn't let go, the power of incumbents to keep control of processes. And that's what the military-industrial complex is all about. But there's also, you know, the same thing happens in industry and agriculture and across the board. And when you sort these things out, you find it's not just evil corporations and governments. It's companies, government agencies, labor unions, professional associations, all of the little silos that we split ourselves into so that we can represent these little pieces of ourselves.
Right.
And they gain too much concentrated power. The way to break out of that is for us to break out of those silos, to stop pretending that unions necessarily support the interests of workers, that corporations necessarily support the interests of consumers, that government necessarily supports the interests of citizens. Yeah, we all have to break out of those silos, and you know, we need something of an organic grassroots movement. That's going to take courage on the part of our political leaders. We need some of them to just break out of the system and say that their objective is not to be elected, but to actually help drive change. And we need some courage on the part of progressives and conservatives to break out of their rhetorical bounds and begin to work together.
It could happen. People, I mean, we still are a republic of the people. So, Bill Scheinman, if people are interested in following up on Future 500 and what you're up to, there's a website you can point them to, no doubt.
Yes, indeed. Future500.org. Visit us, subscribe, and we will be happy to help anyone get involved in these issues if they desire.
Thank you so much, Bill Scheinman of Future 500. Thanks for being with us, and I hope we can talk again. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
We'll see if any winds of change are actually coming. We will see. Thanks very much for listening. Keep in touch. Bert at bertcohen.com.